Pauline Kael, renowned film critic and columnist, began her career in the 1950s and 60s broadcasting her unique style of film criticism on Pacifica station KPFA in Berkeley. With the spirit of community radio and non-censorship, Kael honed her intelligent, literate, and witty criticisms.
There is a feeling, for example, that the underground movie makers are great guys because they praise each other. There is a general feeling that critics are bad because they are slashing and rationalistic, whereas people who praise films are somehow considered good. What isn't understood in this is how difficult it is in the state of the modern mass media to pan movies and to pan them with any depth. There are almost no American magazines in which a film critic is free to say what he wants to say. And I don't know why this should be so little understood. Magazines with a circulation of over 1 million are heavily conditioned by their advertisers. And with just about the single exception of Newsweek, I think that no magazine with a circulation of over 1 million allows its film critic to be free. That means that most of the film critics praise almost everything or pan very lightly or pan films that have no substantial advertising budget behind them that are safe to pan. For example, they can easily pan Godard and talk about how self-indulgent he is because there's no big money behind his movies. But at the same time, these people who praise every movie are then quoted in the ads, and their names are built up, and they become rather important figures. They are, in a sense, celebrities because everyone knows their names. And they are also nice guys within the industry. So there is no movement to make them look ridiculous in print. Variety doesn't pan them. Nobody's out to get them. Whereas the few independent critics not only have a very difficult time reaching any large audience, but are subject to every whim of the industry. For example, last year, four of the majors wouldn't allow me into screenings. That meant I couldn't review their movies in time to make the deadline on any major magazine. Now, this is a standard form of coercion, and this is fairly well known. But what isn't known is the general way that reviews are slanted to appease the advertisers and the readers. A magazine like Life magazine, for example, is much more worried about its readers, about offending some of them, than they are about their advertisers, because they're in a fairly strong position. But there is another aspect to this. The magazines are also closely related to the film companies. I don't think you realize how closely they're all owned. The same way, you know, Random House is owned by RCA. MGM is owned partly by Life by Time Life. So that when you see 12 pages on Space Odyssey in Time Life, it could conceivably be labeled advertisement. And almost all directors come out of stage directing, writing, or related fields. But you know, it's a different kind of temperament and a different approach to life, the cameraman's and the directors. And most cameramen have no sense of how to work with actors or how to work with story material. They tend to be interested simply in the visuals. So you do, there is one cameraman who's now working in movies, and that's Claude Lelouch, whose work I detest because it has that real Vogue magazine graphics look. It's completely a cameraman's thinking. Or you get something else, you get a man who started as a still photographer, Stanley Kubrick, whose work goes almost completely in terms of whether he has a good script. Because when he does, I think he can do something with it. But when he tries to bring his own thoughts or develop his own thoughts, I think you get something as blurry and dim-witted and basically stoned as 2001. In which, you know, you don't have to worry about this world anymore because everything's taken care of in heaven, and just join the extraterrestrial intelligence and you'll be reborn as a little star. This tends to be cameraman's thinking in a peculiar way. You make beautiful effects. You get a lot of hardware in space. But the elements of man are left out of it. As a matter of fact, I think you could say that the subtitle of Strange Love, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, was not really satiric. It was true. And 2001 is the result. He really literally fell in love with technology. And so he's become the Belasco of outer space.
Film critic Pauline Kael from April of 1968. Kael died in 2001.
This Revolution Rewind moment was made possible by the Pacifica Radio Archives with support from you, the Pacifica listener. To join the revolution, call us at 1-800-735-0230.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
And now we return to our 1960 interview with French film master Jean Renoir.
We spoke of TV a little while ago. Do you think that the influence of TV on the motion picture industry, of course, economically it's been disastrous, but has it been positive or negative insofar as film quality is concerned?
Well, I believe that in any case, the film business was at the, I wouldn't say at a dead end, but at a spot where there's a necessity to change, to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that any form of show business, may I say, of show art,
mm-hmm.
can last. Let's take, for instance, the melodramas. Well, the melodramas during the Romantic period were really what everybody wanted to see. Any melodrama in New York or in Paris or in London was very successful. The houses were packed, and nobody could have believed that ever the success of melodramas would end. Well, it did end. A certain day, nobody knows why, nobody anymore wanted to see a melodrama. And people started to write something else. They started to write what we call in French the comédie du boulevard, which means, you know, the modern plays of, about as they are today. Well, and they will arrive at an end. Also, it's the same thing with the movies. For, 40 years, we told about the same stories.
Mm-hmm.
After all, we were the heirs of the melodramas and of the stage comedies. Well, now the time arrived when we have to do something else. That's very normal. Now, may I say that TV helped us to realize that we must do something
mm-hmm.
else. I believe if we talk about the artistic problems, I believe that TV was excellent to wake up the film industry.
In Europe, the major writers, the major literary figures, are much more connected with the film industry. Is that true?
I didn't notice it. Perhaps it is true. But I have the feeling that in Paris, I don't know in London, but in Paris as well as in Hollywood, I have the feeling that the writing of screenplays is the fact of a specialist.
I see.
Same thing as here. Probably it is different in Italy. I have the feeling that in Italy, artists are more interested in different forms of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's very good. Because since the perfection of technique today makes us free to try to attempt anything, well, we must forget a little bit about technique. And anybody can express himself, I think, in a different way. I believe very firmly that an author is an author, and he could express himself in a movie, on TV, or on the stage, or in a novel, just the same.
An author is an author insofar as the various forms of show art are primarily literary.
Yes.
It seems to me that, to a great extent, the film in this country has been rather non-literary.
Yes, and maybe, you know, in many cases, maybe it wasn't a bad thing. After all, there were many Hollywood masterpieces, and more in the beginning, which had no literary value and which were very good films.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that any author should direct pictures. I think so. I think it's a wonderful training, because you learn how to yield in front of realities of life. You know, you write a wonderful line. This line is beautiful. You repeat it to yourself in your imagination. And it happens that no actor can say it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that shows that your line is bad. You must rewrite it. And that's a good lesson,
mm-hmm.
good training.
What I really meant to say was that any author can write for any medium, in so long as that medium permits a certain amount of emphasis and a great deal of interest in the writing, in the text itself, and does not obscure it or weight it down with technical gimmickry and...
Yes, I agree with you, but I believe that even the writing itself, the art of writing, may I say the technique of writing, mm-hmm. is something which is not as important today than it was before. I have the feeling that we are really at the turning, not of a century, but of the history of the world. I believe that we are living in a very important period as the beginning of the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And probably the difference between our days, which are still the end of the Renaissance, uh-huh. and the days in the future will be as big as the difference between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And perhaps we go back to a kind of Middle Ages when artists were universal. When, you know, let's take a man of the Renaissance, but who still had the spirit of a man of the Middle Ages, that Leonardo da Vinci. Uh-huh. He could do anything. Mm-hmm. He had to express himself. He could express himself with an invention, the invention of an airplane, or with a statue, or with a painting, or with some writing. And to me, we're going to arrive to a conception of the author very close to the conception of the Middle Ages. The conception, let's say, of the troubadours, of the trouvères, of those men, of those artists who were traveling from one castle to another one, from one city to a village, and who were doing the whole show. They were doing the whole show. They were not writing the story. The story wasn't important. The story was always the same one. Mm-hmm. The Song of Roland was told 100 times by 100 different people, but in a different way.
That's a fascinating idea.
It is. In India. India is very important to us today, because in India you have all the different ages of the world. If in certain parts, not of India, but in certain parts of any village in India, any city, or in the part of the spirit of any man in India, you have the Middle Ages still. Exactly, absolutely pure. For instance, Indian music is based exactly on the same principles as our music before the scale. Mm-hmm. After all, Indian music is what? And Indian literature is what? A general story. A story which was told thousands and thousands and thousands of times. They believe that, after all, this story is not so important, that it is useless to try to find another one. But within this frame, the artist is absolutely free. It is a kind of improvisation about music, about the words, about the dancing, about the expressions, about everything. And in other words, today, we are torturing ourselves to find new stories, new plots. Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that during the Middle Ages, the great Western art was also without, I don't say without a plot, but without giving any importance to the plot. Mm-hmm. The importance was in the expression, in the human expression about a plot. But the plot was only a springboard to bring up the human expression. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I like that. And I have the feeling that we go back to this way of expression, and that's great.
Mr. Renoir, you're teaching a group of seminars at the university this semester. Could you tell us something about them?
Yes, gladly. But teaching is a very ambitious word. I'm not exactly teaching. We just have some meetings. We don't even use the word seminar. We use the word meetings. And during those meetings, I'm just trying to attract the attention of the students on several things which to me seem to be important in the making of the work of art. Now, I warn them that I express only my personal opinion, that this personal opinion may be very wrong, according to the different personalities which are listening to me.
Can you give us an example of...
Yes, as a matter of fact, all my talks turn around the same idea. And it is the idea that the human approach to any problem is more important than the technical approach. I sometimes quote this line by the French philosopher Pascal, which is the following one. there is only one thing which interests man, and it's man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for instance, about acting. Well, I'm trying to explain to them that it is wrong to act the situation first. You must act the character. And when you know how to act the character, when you are the character, well, you will react in front of the situation as the character would do. And that brings more reality. Now, to bring reality is very important. After all, it is exactly, perhaps, the purpose of art. But this reality must be rich. And to be rich, each personality we show on a screen or on a stage must be loaded with personal recollections, must be not exactly as we see it during the situation. In other words, a scene must not be like a piece of food you put inside an icebox, surrounded by vacuum, surrounded by things which are dead. A scene must be like a stone into the clear water of a lake. It makes rings, and the more rings, the better it is. And I believe that the actor must arrive on the stage, on the screen, full of recollection. We must guess that this actor is not only living the present minute, the minute which goes with the situation. This actor must live a whole life. And we must guess that there is a whole life. And if we don't guess it, he's not a human being. He's just just a cliché. Mm-hmm. It's just a cliché, and the play becomes an accumulation of clichés. Mm-hmm. Now, if this man or this girl brings something of her, of his past, well, we start to be interested. Of course, I believe that it's dangerous to tell too much about this past. Mm-hmm. We must keep the mystery. That's the interest of a show, to guess. I even pretend that in a good show, the public is also the maker of the show. A good show starts with the writing of the story and ends with the public happy or unhappy. And the public, adding to any situation, his own recollection, his conception of the part. A girl enters the scene. This girl seems to be unhappy. Well, she doesn't say why. The public must guess why. The public must guess where she was born, must guess how were the parents, if she was rich or poor, if the beautiful dress she is wearing is something new, or if she is used to wear such beautiful dress since she was a little girl. Perhaps she was an unhappy little rich girl. Perhaps she was too happy in life, and now she's confronted all of a sudden with a difficult situation. All those things perhaps must not be said, but the public should guess that they do exist, and the public should add them, and by adding them, he must collaborate to the play. Now, of course, this process, let's say this work I'm asking from the public, this work is also, and even more, the work of the director, the work of the actors. That means that a play is always in the making. The writer delivers the play. Well, the actors must read more than the lines say directly. Behind the lines, we must feel the whole life of an author. We must feel that this man, perhaps, is hiding things. Perhaps he got a secret. Well, we must be interested by this secret. And the actor must not only arrive filled with recollections about himself, but a man alone in this world, I believe, is not interesting. The actor must arrive with an expression of the little world he belongs to. Perhaps if he's a man of... Perhaps if the character is a very important character, he should arrive with some idea about the whole world, an entire nation, perhaps. But even if he arrives with just the feeling of a small group of humanity, that's enough. He's no more alone, he's interested. In other words, we must not be selfish, and we must not believe that us alone, our little case is sufficient to interest men. Men are interested by ourselves and plus what we learned, what we caught, what we gathered from the people living around us. We must be an expression of humanity and not only one human being.
Of course, on the stage or on the screen, this is communicated to the audience via technique, and technique is still, I would imagine, very important.
I believe that techniques are, of course, necessary, but they're also very dangerous. We arrive at a point where technique may absolutely kill any human expression with the actors. We arrive at the point where, in order to catch a beautiful lighting on the side of a face, well, we forget the character, we forget the human being, which, after all, is the primary importance in a show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we're basically in any kind of disagreement. What I'm thinking of when I ask this question is a technique, for instance, like that Brecht asked of his actors, which was really a technique of simplicity and the admission of the artificiality of the theater, and in a sense, I think a rebellion from the proliferating techniques of naturalism and the creation of the illusion of realism.
With Brecht, the case is different. Mm-hmm. May I say that Brecht is probably the most important writer and director of our days.
I entirely agree.
Mm-hmm. And Brecht not only created human beings, characters, but he created a world which was beyond the world of his own plays, which was also the mm-hmm. world of the people working and living with him. Mm-hmm. That means that they were all belonging to this world as you belong to a nation or to a religion, and they were all thinking together. And that was the influence of a great man. That happened sometimes. That happened, for instance, let's say in history, with saints. It is obvious that people around St. Francis of Assisi were also reacting together to the same ideas, laughing almost at the same jokes, and on a very high level, because this process could be just the opposite of good art. This process could be applied also to very low-level ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. But with Brecht, it was very high. And I must say that every word said by any actor acting for Brecht is not only the expression of Brecht, but it is the expression of the whole group. And this whole group is the expression of a big part of humanity. There is a Brecht language, which is not only the German language, which is a certain sense of humor, mm-hmm. which is a certain mm-hmm. attitude in front of the world. Number one, every member of the cast uses and is still talking this language. Oh, that's very important. Perhaps that's the first thing to create if we want a new art movement. It is to create a common language among the people working in the shows. And Brecht did it beautifully. Now, sometimes he had to give up. The war stopped him. And at the end of his life, he found again what he had found in Berlin in the beginning when I knew him so well, when he was showing the Dreigroschen Oper.
You did know Brecht?
Oh, yes, very well. He was a good friend of mine. He used to come to my house in Paris. I used to live in a suburb on a hill in Meudon, exactly Bellevue, that's near Meudon. Mm-hmm. A beautiful view all over Paris. And it's an old district with old houses. My house was a dilapidated house, but delightful. Probably a bit of an old convent, a few walls remaining from a convent. And Brecht used to come to see me. Very often he had some actor and actress of his group with him. And we used to talk, and he used to play music, or to ask, for instance, his secretary to play music. Very often they used to play of a very small accordion, an octagonal, you know, eight-side mm-hmm. accordion. And he was very much interested in French folklore music, old popular French music, and he used many old French tunes for his work. About all the tunes in his works were found by himself. He used to play them, to have them played by some friend on the accordion for days, days and nights.
I know a good many of the songs were written by him as settings to poems.
Yes, Kurt Weill, of course, was a wonderful partner. He was a wonderful partner, but in such a group, the imagination, may I say, the life was coming from Brecht. Mm-hmm. And Kurt Weill was a man of an enormous talent. We saw it later when he started to work alone. But, well, as anybody around Brecht, he was more or less following Brecht. With Brecht, that was very different. Brecht was a master. He was a master with exactly the middle-aged meaning of master, the master who gathers a group of people and help them not only to work, not only to find new techniques or to renew old techniques, but even to think and mm-hmm. to adopt a kind of understanding of the world. But we'll always remember during the war, Brecht was in Hollywood. And I was explaining people, you know that here in this town, you have probably the greatest contemporary author. And they say, who is he? Brecht. Oh, you mean Drescht? No, Brecht. Oh, yes, yes. Now, as for your question about the way I'm trying to attract the attention of the students on such important problems, well, let's say on one important problem, which is the problem of humanity in our work. I do it with examples. I take a scene from a play, for instance, I took several times a few lines in Giraudoux, I believe in The Enchanted. I ask students to read them, and I discuss with them the way to read those lines. In other words, I start from a very precise example. Of course, it's not the real work of a director, and it's not the real work of an actor, since they had no time to learn the lines. And you start to work really when you know the lines, after absorbing the lines, after making the lines your own lines. That I cannot do. I could do it with more time on the way. But in any case, that helps me to explain several problems and to pass from the particular problem of expressing a certain feeling during an entrance or an exit to more general problems, the problem of the kind we are talking about now.
Well, thank you very, very much for being with us here today, Mr. Renoir.
You have been listening to a 1960 interview with French film director Jean Renoir, one of the masters of the cinematic art. Mr. Renoir died in 1979.